This is Ben Crenshaw. You're listening to Radio Golf Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, friends and foes, meine Damen und Herren, welcome to the program. We are glad that you are here. My name is Frank Forster, and I will be your host for the next hour or so. It gives us a tremendous sense of satisfaction whenever we have the opportunity to welcome back a former guest. It validates what we do. Tonight, we bring you, for your dining and dancing pleasure, the one and only Mr. Lori Montague. The last time you visited us, Lori, in November of 2021, this little podcast was still called Die Golfschau mit Frank Förster, which we felt had too much of that German Guten Morgen vibe for a show that even then was listened to in over 50 countries. Oh. Leading up to that first conversation, which ended up in 2021, which ended up lasting 2 hours and 40 minutes, you were generous enough to allow us to publish your story of the old pro in English and in German on our social media channels. And it was quite a thrill to be first to market with that wonderful story. Thank you again for that. And welcome back. Well, welcome to the first time to Radio Golf Show.
Thank you very much, Frank. It's a pleasure to be on and to see you again after, well, I mean, we've chatted a little bit over the last few years, but it's 3 years since I was on last time. It's extraordinary. We were just saying prior to the start of the show that how it was an extraordinary time, where that time we did have the 2 hours together.
Yeah.
Extraordinary time across the world. And you know, we're all back to, well, what normal is.
we found our way.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. We're still talking about the good things.
Yeah.
Focusing on the good things.
Today, though, I would like to talk, or we would like to talk about some other topics, primarily maybe, you know, the mental game, practicing, knowing how to score when you're not playing well, things that are interesting not only for elite players but for average players. Maybe a little bit of tournament golf, and if we have enough time, some of the overambitious parents of juniors. You are first and foremost the director of coaching and player development at the National Golf Institute of Indonesia. You are a member of the PGA of Australia since 1985. Happy 40th.
Thank you, mate. Thank you so much. It's a bit of a milestone, that one.
Yeah, you are a mental toughness golf coach, and you are a high performance coach in sports and business. Let's start there. What is a high performance coach?
In simple terms, a high performance coach is someone who helps you to move beyond the goals that you appear to be stuck with. In other words, it's taking someone who's got the potential within them and extracting that, getting it out of them, driving them further than they've ever been before. At least that's the idea behind it. You know, I'm always reminded when I talk about performance about Tim Galway, who wrote an excellent book, The Inner Game of Tennis, and one called The Inner Game of Golf, and the Galway equation: performance equals potential minus interference, which is well known. It's a well-known equation or formula, if you will. And what I like about it the most is that there's always this potential there, Frank, to be better than you are. And then, you know, if you want to raise performance, you want to move it up, say, that Galway talks about the interference that gets in the way, the distraction, that side of it. Mm-hmm. So I think as a performance coach, a high-performance coach, my focus is on removing the stuff that gets in the way. Obviously, you're not going to remove it all, but where some things can't be removed, you know, is there another strategy for getting around it, under it, over it, through it? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm always thinking in terms of when I'm working with people around the performance side of things, whether it's in business, sports, or life, is what's getting in the way, you know, how, and then what sort of strategies can we develop, mm-hmm, that are things that we can do which means we might have to stretch ourselves a little bit out of uncomfortable zone, out of the uncomfortable zone, but not much. The thing is, I think people sometimes get awfully scared when they're with someone who may be working with, say, elite players all the time, that you're somehow going to make them feel so uncomfortable they're going to lose what they've got. And coaching is always about this balance of just giving people enough to satisfy their needs. Some people want a lot, some people don't need a lot. So I think so the performance coaching side for me is those three components. There's potential there, there's interference there, and the idea is to raise the bar. So to raise the bar, you've got to be able to look at, what are the constraints? What are the things that
The potential is obviously based on the technical fundamentals. We're talking about golf. I mean, you got to have a fundamental base of how good you're going to get.
I think that's one side of it. For me, the potential is the potential to learn whatever it is that has to be learned. So, technical being one aspect of it, obviously, there's a huge strategic component that's not talked about. When we talk component like strategy, invariably the story is golf strategy, like how to play a hole. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about the time we get up in the morning from the beginning of the day to the end of the day and all the things that we do throughout the day that influence the things that we want to achieve in our life. So for me, the potential side of it is it's all encompassing. It's many things. It's not any one thing. And certainly in my program, developing the people that I work with, when I look at potential, I look at a lot more than just the, say, the golf swing. That being said, a lot of average players who just want to play the game to enjoy themselves a little bit more and hit a few more shots out of the center of the club face. I mean, one of the areas where you're going to raise their potential is what you said. It's around improving their technical base for sure.
Well, I'd be the last guy to tell anybody anything about the golf swing, even though I've played for over 40 years, but I have no clue about the golf swing. Some of those interference, as you said, it starts when you get up in the morning. It obviously involves your environment, the people that you're close to. I mean, it all of those things influence your potential and therefore your peak performance. But all the stuff that we're going to talk about today, I think, has nothing to do with the golf swing. But can you train the golf brain like you train golf muscles?
Yes, absolutely. You can train people to learn techniques and to recognize so that when they're in certain environments and they're responding in a way that's getting in the way, if you will. So, in other words, they're responding in a way that's actually leading them to struggle. You can train them to recognize when those moments arise and do things about it. Absolutely, you can. It's just that it's not the sexiest thing about golf for a lot of people. They just want to stand on a driving range and peel the ball across and whack it off the rubber mat out into the open range. And there's something to be said for that, for developing repetition, Frank. But at the end of the day, the context is a massive part of it. There are three things that we can think about in terms of developing golfers around what we're talking about. One would be, and you mentioned environment before, so we talk about context, where the learning is taking place. Is it taking place on a driving range primarily? If it is, and let's say someone becomes really competent at hitting, at pouring a bucket of balls into a tray and then scraping each ball over and then whacking it out into the range, and they become really competent at that. So they're actually increasing their potential for doing that. But then when they get on the golf course and they stand on the first tee in front of their clubhouse and their group is waiting to tee off, and then there's two groups behind them and they're also mulling around on the tee, and this particular person has been whacking balls on driving ranges willy-nilly for a long and got competent at it, but now they've got to hit one golf shot. And they've got to hit that one golf shot into play, and now they're self-conscious about the environment around them. So what happens there? The perception is that there's some sort of a threat, and And with this threat, it affects them at the level of the permission level. The permission level is, can I give myself permission to hit this golf shot with all this interference around? Well, if you have just stood on a driving range peeling across a golf ball with, say your right hand forming a grip and whacking it down the range, and you've done that a lot of times, that particular activity, it does not represent the same activity that you're going to be engaging in when you hit that one golf shot with people watching it. It may seem like it's the same, but it's not. And I think all your listeners know that, when they feel incredibly nervous and self-conscious before they make the swing. And yet at the same time, they might be thinking to themselves, why am I nervous? Because I've hit lots of practice balls. I mean, I practice a lot. Why do I feel nervous now? And then, of course, they invariably stand up there and hit a bad golf shot that they may have even thought they were going to hit. And then there lies this challenge for so many people, even professional, even elite level golfers struggle with this thing, that the environments are different. They're not the same. So the perception's different in terms of what I'm actually dealing with. And the permission side of it is, I give myself permission to do it a certain way in one place, but I don't give myself permission to do it in another place. That other place being, I've got to hit one golf shot and I want to hit it properly. And now there's an expectation associated with that. And maybe my dad's standing over there and he's got his arms folded and I'm looking at his body language. And, I'm feeling that as well. Like, there's so many factors, in other words. So when you mentioned environment before, it's all of these things that are taking place in the environment and what you're paying attention to, and also what you're not paying attention to, even more so.
One of my favorite Laurie quotes is "Practice is not about repetition. Practice is about transformation." And I think you just talked about
Absolutely,
that.
spot on. It's all about that.
Can you
It's
walk
all about
us
that.
through that transformation?
Yeah, so transformation is being able to do it, right? It's about you do the repetition, but you do it in a way that you transform yourself to be able to adapt to the particular situation you're in and achieve in that particular situation. And it wouldn't matter whether it's someone in a work environment or any type of sporting environment or anywhere. We are always moving through contexts, different locations, different situations. In other words, the environment's constantly changing. So what is it that I have to be able to do really well in that situation? It's not stand there and hit golf shots with a perfect swing. It's being able to execute one golf shot when I have to. That's really what it gets down to. So that's what is not being done. A lot of people take golf lessons and they go and stand on the rubber mat and they have the lesson with their pro, and then the pro moves on to the next lesson. And so they then, do the right thing and they buy themselves another bucket of balls and they hit them out on the driving range. But that has no real relevance to what's going to happen on the golf course.
And
It's just different. And they don't recognize the difference until they get out there and go, oh my gosh, this is different.
and the way I understand it, I mean, this is and that's why I started off with the question, what's a high performance coach? A high performance coach, when I hear it, you think, oh, this is something that's really only for the best players, the
Yeah.
best talents and the best players in the world. But I think it's important to point out that this transformation and these this golf brain that you can work on and develop and train like a just like a muscle is available for everybody
You bet
on
it
every
is.
level, on every.
Absolutely, it is. Yeah. I suppose it's, and people do go out of their way. They'll buy a book by, say, Bob Rotella or
Rotella,
somewhere
yeah.
on mental skills. And but it's it's one thing to be reading about this stuff. It's another to actually immerse yourself in the types of routines that are actually going to transform you from a someone who's competent at swinging the golf club on a driving range with a lot of golf balls in front of you into an open range, to someone who can stand on a tee with a narrow fairway, bunkers and whatever other hazards are around, and feel confident that you can, hit your shots in that environment with confidence. And so if people began from that position, Frank, wouldn't that be helpful if you said, what is it really that I have to be able to do to be the type of golfer that I want to become? And that is, well, I want to be able to hit golf shots when I have to. Hit them more the way I want, closer to my expectation, when I want to. But if you just go to the driving range and scrape balls over and hit them, how is that going to do that? That's going to help the repetition side. And maybe there's some assumption there that, maybe people sort of think that, well, if I hit a lot of golf balls somehow and in some way, it'll transform me. Well, yes, you'll be very competent at hitting the ball on the driving range. That's for sure. If you hit enough golf balls, you'll be able to stand there and people will be pretty impressed because you'll find a way to hit the ball very well on the driving range. But the golf course is a different place.
And
There lies the problem.
right, but let's take a step back to dispelling two myths, and dispelling myths is one of our favorite things to do because we sometimes consider ourselves highly skilled bullshit detectors, and then there's obviously a lot of that out there. But the two common myths that I want to go after today is number one, that golf psychology is only for problem golfers. You know, people, oh, it's like they associate the word psychology with a problem. And two, that mental skills are only important for elite players. Now, and maybe a way into that is if we think about what golf really is. And golf is that seductive game, you know, the temptress, because there are so many ways to enjoy it. The walking, the exercise, the camaraderie with the guys in your group, you know, the 300-yard drive, competition for some, build character, whatever you want, and they're all fine reasons to play the game. But to me, all of those reasons are subordinated to the number one reason why we all play, and that is to score. We play because we want to score better. I think people who say, "Well, I love golf because I'm out the open air and I'm exercising, blah blah blah, and I don't care if I shoot 120, 130, I don't care." I don't think that's reasonable.
I agree with you. I think that someone standing there and putting a small putt in for a 12 is not going to be nearly as happy as if the six, if they had a six.
Right, exactly.
Right. Yeah. So I think that there is a scoring element to it for sure. Golf is a game of score.
Exactly. It's a game of score. That's the basis of golf.
Yeah.
And it applies to every, it doesn't apply to the guys that shoot 63, 64 on the most difficult golf courses in the world. It applies to the 15 handicap who shoots 90 on the average that one day shoots 86.
Yes, absolutely, it does.
And
Same.
right. And even when he shoots an 86, not hitting the ball well, but scoring well.
Yeah.
Would you agree that many people don't shoot lower scores because they don't know how to play?
Yes, I think we need to explore the how to play, but I 100% agree with you. Playing the game and understanding playing the game means you have to understand the nature of the game. And so we should talk about the nature of the game. The nature of the game. Nature of the game is that it's a cross-country exercise. It starts in one place and it finishes in another, and you cross country. And when you cross country, there are all sorts of things can happen. And not only is it about the weather, but it's about all the different conditions that the golf ball finds itself in. And so the key thing becomes, well, to play the game, you have to have an adaptable skill set, not a skill set, an adaptable skill set. And there lies a problem because a lot of people have a skill set that they learn, say, in one place. I'll come back to context again. They learn, say, the driving range, and they develop a skill set, but it's not an adaptable skill set because if you go to the driving range and you pull out the pitching wedge and you hit a few of those, then you pull out the 7-iron, you hit a few of those, then you pull out your hybrid and hit a few of those, then your driver. And let's say you do that, 3 times a week, and that's pretty much what you call practice. Then how is that an adaptable skill set? What happens when you hit it down the second hole when you're playing with your friends and it's on a hanging lie? It's balls above your feet, let's say. It's in 3-inch rough, ball sitting down at 3-inch rough. You've got to hit over a cluster of bunkers onto a green. Now you haven't practiced that at all. So the adaptable skill set is playing the game is about developing an adaptable skill set. Playing the game It's about understanding the nature of the game, how it changes all the time. And then that raises a couple of questions. So how are you adapting from a physical sense? So you're walking and, the environment's changing, but the golf swing's also changing, going from short swings to long swings. You've got punch shots in there. You've got every type of different shot in amongst all of that. And then there's the mindset. The mindset, is your mindset adaptable? Because if you're the guy who hits the pitching wedge, then the 7-iron, then the hybrid, then the driver, and that's how you practice, then what kind of mindset are you developing? Well, the mindset is, it's like a an algorithm where, there are four basic clubs that you keep hitting, so you keep firing the same algorithm over the over and over. Well, you can't expect a different result, because when you design that algorithm, it's designed to go A, B, C, D, E, A, B, C, D, A, B, C, D, A, B, C, D. Now you go into a changeable environment with the A, B, C, D approach, and it's going to work a little bit. You will be able to hit some shots, but there's no way you're going to be able to adapt to ever-changing conditions. So the playing the game is to understand the nature of the game. The nature of the game is it's ever-changing. Weather-wise, everything. Can you hit low shots? Can you hit high shots? Can you play it out of the rough? Can you play it off side hill lies? Can you pitch it off tight turf? Do you, here in Indonesia, the fairway height is, 3 to 5 millimeters high, right? So maybe half a centimeter to a centimeter in some places. And so, a lot of people can go in there with their lofted clubs and pitch it off that beautiful lie around the greens. But if they go and play in countries where the turf is really firm, no grass on it, and you have to pitch it off a very tight lie, you're not going to be as effective at that. So I know in our program, learning the game, all the students in my program, when they come to me, Frank, they all start golf in, and you're familiar with Jakarta, but they all start golf on a driving range, on a rubber mat and a driving range. And then, and we have a we have the only grass facility in Indonesia, like full grass, full time. We don't have the mats. So when these kids come and they start training with me, they produce divots that are about, you can put your foot into those divots and you'll lose half your shoe in it, because they're hitting down so much. But the mat is not telling them that. The mat's not giving them that feedback. The other thing is, I can go up to them and I can get my thumb and squeeze it into the side of their forearm and until they yelp with pain, because now they've also got tendonitis from hitting on rubber mats. So there's all these things that affect the way they play, but mainly it's about this algorithm of A, B, C, D. They've got to be taught how to make shallower divots. They've got to be taught how to use clubs differently and so on. So that's what you want. I think, for your listeners that really want to, when we talk about playing the game, and I love that that expression, playing the game. But we have to tell them, well, what does that really mean? That's what it means. It's, you've got to understand the nature of what it's about. The platform for golf is built on randomness and uncertainty. Now, if it's built on randomness and uncertainty, how you improve people is through probability, not certainty. That you can't be certain about anything in golf, but you can increase the probability of success by identifying factors that are you could call them constraints, if they're things that get in the way of you performing, and modifying them in some way so that they're less of an issue. So playing the game is this constant evolution of identifying things that are getting in the way and modifying your approach and your techniques to be able to manage those conditions more effectively. That's what playing the game is all about.
Well, now, I don't play that much anymore, but I find myself standing on a tee, addressing my ball and having no idea where the ball is going to go. Not because I don't know how to swing the golf club, because I can't control what my mind is telling me. To this adaptable skill set that you speak of, I mean, obviously there are the technical things you mentioned, the punch shot, and all these, how you hit the different shot. But from the mental side, I think the important factors to play are, number one, attitude, right? Being able to deal with pressure, with fear, with anger. It has to do, you mentioned it already, the strategy, having a picture of what you want to do, And obviously your preparation and your visualization of the shot, all things that have nothing to do with the golf swing, right?
Right, absolutely.
When you work with your kids, and how old are those kids? What's the range, if I may ask?
Oh, sure. They're anything from 12 years of age to 20.
And how good are they when they come to you?
Not very good. Not very good at all. They're probably shooting in the 90s to maybe 100. And if they stick with the program and so on, they definitely shave strokes. But my program is also about shaping them. Our slogan is champions in golf, champions in life. So mine is all about personal development as well. I want those kids to be able to go through school and be better at school, better at focusing in school, better in social environments, being more confident, standing up there. I'm proud of some of the kids that came into my program. They were as quiet as a mouse, and now they're on debating teams in their school, and they've just really grown from what golf teaches them, and our program teaches them about adapting and resilience and all of these. We've got to transcend the words, Frank. It's one thing, like when we talk mental skills, we talk all of those things. We say you've got to have the attitude, and you've got to have this, and you've got to have that. But it's actually not. They're beautiful words, but they're just words. What we're really talking about is the transformation of behavior in context, in an environment, wherever it happens to be. So some of my best players are learning, and I'm seeing it more and more, where they can go into what would be considered a more pressure-filled environment, or they play themselves into that, and they're managing it more effectively than they did when they first came into the program. And you might say, well, that's just experience too, Laurie. I say, well, it is, but it's also training them for that reason alone. That if you want to be really good at golf, whatever that means, whatever it means, whatever level, you've got to understand what what Stephen Covey talked about in his very famous book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Begin with the end in mind. What would it look like if I did this well? So for me, the strategy is, okay, let's go to the end and say, what would you be able to do if you were the golfer you really wanted to be? That you can't do right now. Well, in every case, you have to come to a place where, as a golfer gets better and they put themselves into contention, and it could be club championship level, it could be B grade championship, C grade champions, it doesn't matter. But the thing is, what would you have to be able to do that you can't do right now? Well, there's a really important question, because the transformation process is understanding this outcome, this thing you want to have that you don't currently have. And then coming back to the beginning and working out what you need to do to be able to achieve that step by step. So golf, playing the game, and let's say playing it at a level where there is more pressure involved, and that's your own pressure you put on yourself plus that around you. If you start there and then you say, well, that's what I have to be able to really do well, then you come back to the beginning, you start to build the parts into the system, if you were. In other words, you expand on this algorithm, and it's got six parts instead of four. And one of those parts is it has the adaptability factor involved in it. That whatever conditions you're in, whether it's wet conditions or dry or windy or cold or hot, you can adapt better than the next person can.
So this is the depth of the real change, and you talk about these, and I gave you, this is a perfect example. I gave you a bunch of words. Visualization, that really don't mean anything. I mean, and we had talked about, Rotella's book, which, I read it, and Bernard Langer comes on TV and says, or somebody says the game is 99% mental, and Bernard Langer comes on TV and says that's bullshit, because, if you don't know how to play, it's not that important. How do you deal with those catchphrases when you hear them, other than shake your head, maybe. But one of the most popular ones, obviously, for the average player, is that you got to have a blank mind, or think of nothing, or whatever. I don't know what the English way is of saying it, but that you have an empty mind, which is kind of what Rotella says. But it's if you have a completely empty mind, you're not going to be able to execute a golf shot.
No, I think I would say that, I mean, first and foremost, if we're moving through levels of learning, we want to get to a place where For instance, Frank, if I said to you now, pick up a pen and sign your name, you could stand up, you could pick that pen up, put it on paper, and sign your signature. Now, if I said to you then, sign your signature exactly like the last signature, it wouldn't be as easy because I've asked you to now think about it. And that's where a lot of golfers are, Frank. They don't get to that level of signing the signature. They get to the level of, I can recognize a signature. I know I can write that signature, but I have to think about it. There lies the challenge. Can we get to the place where we can just sign the signature, sign the check? No. Golf, because golf's not allowing us to do that. Because when people go to learning environments, say they go to have lessons, they give up the right to play by learning how to play, and they never get out of the learning how to play part.
They gave up the right to play by learning how to play it.
Yeah. Now, some people say, yeah, but you've got to learn how to play. But they don't escape from the school. They don't get the graduation certificate that says, you can now go and play golf on the golf course. Go and enjoy yourself. Have fun with your friends. Have exercise, all those things you mentioned about before. That's ultimately what we want to do. But the golf industry is never going to let you do that.
How important when you teach a mental toughness to the kids, because sports psychology is normally taught to vary on an individual basis. How important for you with the kids is mental toughness in teams? I've seen some videos of you where you have the kids putting and if none of them make it, all of them have to run or something like that. It's fascinating to
Yeah, we
what,
do.
what
We
does
have
it
a.
give them as golfers?
So, why we do those things, a couple of reasons. One of the reasons we do that is so that they understand the nature of teams, that when they go into the workforce, they're going to work in teams. As much as they'd like to be locked away in a room on their own, it's probably not going to happen. They're going to be working with other people. So, when they're in school, in classrooms, they're not necessarily doing team stuff per se. So I like to work with our players and give them this team mindset that we're going to do things together, but we're also going to be punished together. See, I'll give you an example. I got a young boy that he has a habit of hitting a golf shot and taking his right hand off the club when he hits a bad one. This is a very common thing in junior golf. You see this a lot. So they hit a shot and then they take one hand off because they've hit a poor shot. And they've seen pros do it on TV
Exactly.
because pros do it. And so I say, okay, and I make So in this example, I need to change his behavior in the context of performance. I need him to be able to keep his hand on the golf club all of the time, set his hands on the club, finish at the top of the, at the finish of the swing all of the time. And so I can tell him all day long and say, don't do that anymore, but it won't do anything. It's like the word attitude, you know, they're just words. They don't transform a person and their behavior. So what I say is I call all the students over together and I say, this young man continues to take his hand off the golf club and we need to help him out here. So every time he does it from now on, his brother, who he trains with, is going to tell me that he took his hand off the club. And all of you are going to run down to the car park, which is half a kilometer away, and back because of this young man. Well, he looks with the fear of God in his face and instantly changes his behavior. He doesn't do it anymore. And so what happens, he keeps doing his repetitions, but now he's doing his repetitions with their hands on the club and not off the club. And I've found a way, a form of leverage, if you will, to toughen him up in one area where he was allowing himself, he was giving himself permission to do it. But the trouble is, it's going to become a habit if I don't get hold of it.
Right.
And I've seen kids that do it all the time, like not my kids. But I've seen kids in tournaments, and they're just copying what they've seen on pros do as well, because a lot of pros
Exactly.
do it. I say, well, that's not the best place for us to start. So, from a team point of view, I can use leverage of the team, and that the team get you know, the consequences of someone doing something affects the whole team.
Right.
That puts the emphasis on that kid to not do it,
Yeah.
but it also means that, the other kids have to understand that there is a team consequence here. And that when they go, let's say they start playing for a university in the United States on a golf team and so on, they have to understand team mind a team mindset. So my program is all about getting them ready for if they go to college, that if they go into the workforce, that.
Right.
Well, that's transcending the golf side of it. It works in golf. It helps my ability to shape behavior, which is what I do. That's the way I would describe that. I'm shaping behavior. I take them into environments. I give them all sorts of pressure training tasks that puts them under pressure, and then I train them on how to manage their state when they're performing those tasks. And it's not something I can do with words. I say so much less than most coaches would say because my environment's different, Frank. I've got 5 hours with them and I'm mostly supervising. And then when I do make changes or when I do add input to something in someone, I'm doing it in context. And I really want to make that point again. And I've said it a few times, but I want to make the change right there while it's happening. I don't want to talk about it as a theory later on or a story later on. One of the other things in our program is kids can't tell stories about their game. So we have this way of evaluating golf. It goes like this. They finish their round, and then I say, what are three things you did well today and three things you want to improve on? And then I stop and just listen. And so they tell me the three things they did well, even if they had a very bad score, and they don't want to tell me, which is most cases. They've had a really bad day, they're quite upset. And my first expectation as the coach is, what are three things you did well today and three things you want to improve on?
What are the three things that you like to hear? I'm sure you don't like to hear I made a birdie on 12.
No, I want to talk to them about the things they're actually working on
Right.
in their program. Certain things that we're developing their attitude around. So attitude in this case, the way they're responding to situations. And they know that. They know that. But the thing is, I always want them to have the flexibility in their being able to express themselves, because when they're feeling upset, when they're under pressure, when they know that they're going to be in the car and their parents are going to ask them why they played so poorly and, all of those normal things that happen, I want them to have the ability to think under pressure, to think clearly. And so I train them from as soon as they come into the program, they learn that regardless of how they play, if they've had the worst round of their life and they're really upset, I'm still going to ask them that question and they're going to have to answer it. And so they're going to learn emotional intelligence. They're going to learn how to answer me when they're under pressure, when they're not feeling like answering. And we're going to improve those answers as we go along. So they might be pretty, basic answers at the beginning of it, but I'd expect by the time it gets to some of my elite players, they're able to dialogue with me about the things that they did that they were quite happy about, where they get into the more of the specifics of it. And then the things they want to improve on, it might be for the next day. What you did today, well, I handled the greens well. I did this well. My speed control, my pace control across the green was really good. But and then they might explain that something was there that they weren't happy with. So this is the thing I'm going to do better tomorrow. In other words, we're not getting stuck in the mire and leaving the scene of the crime without learning something, as I call it in our program. Leaving the scene of the crime without learning something is not questioning how you could have improved on that situation. They don't have to go to the driving range and grind balls after they play. In fact, most of the time I'll say, don't do that because the game's over. We've finished the game for today. We'll just go through the questions and then you go home and enjoy yourself and relax and have some recovery time.
Number one, I'm going to guess that the other kids didn't have too much running to do because
No.
the man started to keep his hand on the club
Straight away.
straight away.
Because he's now thinking, I'm going to punish all my friends in this program, so he's not going to do that. And so he realizes what that does for him. And this is something I learned many years ago. I got to share this quick story with you.
Please.
Many, many years ago, I was listening to it, and back in the days when we had tapes, I was listening to Anthony Robbins talking about a client that he had. And she was sitting across the table from him in this, he was describing this probably to an audience. And this lady was sitting across that he was coaching, and she was going through discussing, what was going on, but it was always going towards very negative things about herself and so on. And there was a pitcher of water on the desk between the two of them, and a glass. And so he says, "Go on, go on." And so he picks up the glass and he starts pouring the pitcher of water, the water into the glass, and he's listening. And then she'd go from this state of explaining to this very emotional state, and he would throw the water straight in the face. And he then said, "When I tell you this," he said, "you have to have really, really, really good rapport with someone to be able to do this." But she then got completely shocked out of what she was saying, and then sort of said, "What in the hell are you, did you do that for?" And he said, "Don't worry, don't carry on with your story. Carry on with your story." And put the glass back down, and he started listening. And she's going back now; she's all drenched, but she's going back through her story again. And then she started to move from this story to a much more emotional place. So he picks up the pitcher and he starts pouring, and she stops straight away. Behavioral shaping. I learned a lot about that from just listening to that story and then thinking about all the people I've worked with over the years, many, many people, and how I've always wanted to be able to shape behavior to get people to do the things that they really want to do in the long term, right? That you want to be better at the game. And the words are just not enough. You have to be able to do something. Mental toughness coaching really is about formulating strategies for getting people to do things they don't want to do, getting them out of
Out of the
types
comfort
of
zone.
behavior. Yeah, and getting out of behaviors that are not leading in the direction they want to go. They're not moving towards the goal so much as they're moving away from the things that they really would like to be better at. And so, you know, when I do things like this with the kids in the program and the clients that I work with, you know, I can construct it as I go along. I listen to what people are saying. I listen to what they want. Sometimes they're not clear on what they want, so we work towards, you know, what it would look like if you had what you wanted, and we, you know, work through that process. But at the end of the day, they need to be able to transform themselves from the idea of it to being able to do it.
Well, all of them understand immediately that it works.
Yeah, it works.
Right?
Absolutely, it works. And
So.
I use it lots of different ways. So not just that one. I
Yeah.
have lots of things I can do similar to that. So we're, you know, one of the ones you see when you see them running around the green, which on a hot day, you know, when it's, you know, 90 degrees, it's and they've gone out and they have more three putts or even a four putt occasionally in one of our routines. They know that if they have more than 10 three putts over 100 holes, which is actually 100 holes is a lot of holes, there's a lot of putting. And that's one of our normal routines. But if they have more than 10 three putts, that the whole team's going to be running for every three putt over 10. If they have a four putts, an instant four laps of everybody. So it's not that they get scared. It's kind of fun as well. They actually have fun with it, but they go, "Oh my," they know, "Oh my God." And then we start adding up all the putts, which means all the rate, all the amounts of laps they're going to do. And then I usually negotiate with them. So I say, "Okay, you as a group, you know what I want. I want you know, you're supposed to do 15 laps now, but we're going to negotiate this. You go away and work together. Come back to me with a better offer. I'll consider it and we'll negotiate on the offer and see what we come up with." Well, they love that side of it. So now they get to do negotiating as well. So they'll all go in their group and they go over here and I'll be waiting because they owe me, right? So I'm the one in power. They owe me and they know that they have to do it. But they'll go and then they'll come back and they'll say, "Well, coach, you know, could we do this? Could we do 10 sit-ups instead? And could we do some of the," and I'll go, "Thank you. That's a great offer. I appreciate it. You really haven't met me where I'm at yet. So I want you to go back and have another think about it. But I like where you're going with it." And so we go through this little process, takes 15 minutes. Well, they learn a lot from that. They learn a lot
I can
about
imagine.
negotiating skills. So our program, Frank, is as you can imagine, is so much more than just the swinging and the hitting. It has that. Of course, they get to do lots of practice, but we have so much more to it because at the end of the day, I'm in my mind, my goal is to get them ready for life. And,
You mentioned
you
you
know,
have 5 hours every day with them, 5 hours a day with them. Is how many times a
yeah.
week?
Well, we coach 5 days a week, so there's the opportunity to be 25 plus hours of supervised training. So different students come on different days depending on what their schedule is. We've got school class. We also have pros that we train so they can come more hours and so on. So, but it's a fascinating way of going about developing them at many different levels, not just obviously the swing and stuff.
How many kids are in the program at one
In
time?
our high performance pro, there are 25 in the program, but at any one time it'll be 10 to 12 kids sometimes, maybe eight. on any particular day. So I've always got a bunch of kids around me.
And how long do they stay with you?
On average, it depends, but I've got kids that have been with me for 2 years. And so I've got a couple of boys that have just been chosen to represent Indonesia. They're 14 years old. They're both scratch players. They've been with me for 2 years. So they've gone from shooting in the high 80s when they came into the program to now shooting low 70s and into the 60s. And they turned 15 this year. So they can get good at the game as well if that's what they want.
So
Kids come into the.
there are kids that want to go that route.
Yeah, there are always, but not many. Most of the kids, I think, I help them more with. Certainly, their golf gets better, but I help them more with their life development skills.
Is that the way you talk to their parents to, I don't know if you have to convince them to come to you. How do the parents react when you talk to them about shaping behavior and the environment at home and their nutrition and whatever it may be, their sleep
Yeah,
habits, I don't know.
all of those things. Well, they don't really understand that when they come into the program, but we have a trial. You can't just come into my program. I have to trial someone. They come for a day, and then I report to the parents at the end and sort of say whether this kid would actually fit into our program. And what that means is that it's not necessarily about the golf skills, but it's the dynamic of fitting in with all the other kids. Because the kids, they act like a family. If you've ever seen videos with the kids, they are incredibly comfortable in that environment, and I want them to be like that. There's discipline there. There's a lot of discipline there, but there's a lot of fun as well. So I want to make sure that the people that come into the program fit in that those values that I suggest are important for our program for the development of the kids in the program.
There's a sense of belonging just by the fact that they're all wearing that Laurie hat.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yeah. Well, that's because it's so hot.
Yeah, they're
They
all
have to
wearing
wear that. Yep, they have to wear that. Yeah, we
it.
have some rebels, but they don't stay rebel very long. And I don't punish them for things like that, but I do say to their parents, "Look, we're out there for 5 hours in the sun. We don't hit balls undercover on a driving range. We're out in the sun for
Right.
5 hours, so it's cooking out there. It is so hot, right? So, and I'm out there for 5 hours, so." If it's good enough for coach to wear a big hat, it's good enough for you guys to wear a big hat.
Exactly. Plus, it's the same thing as a football team wearing the same shirt or a rugby team or whatever. It's belong. I mean, those things alone give them a
Yeah.
sense of togetherness, I would imagine.
That's a big part of it. And that was always the goal, Frank. Like last time I talked to you I hadn't gone back to Jakarta. I had to rebuild the program after I talked to you from nothing. So everything had started again from zero. So that's been an exercise in itself, like starting something from the beginning. A lot of people came into golf, it would be the same in Germany and all over, the post-COVID golfers. They've had a real boom in golfers taking up the game. The same thing happened in Jakarta, and a lot of people started playing the game, and a lot of kids got into the game. But as I said, the key for us is the shaping of the behavior in the environment. I want them to be better at school. I want them to be able to go into a test room and really perform well and be confident they can perform well. I want them to be able to stand up in front of the school, and if they have to present in front of the school, I want them to be able to do that confidently. If they go into the workforce later, I want them to be a great person in the workforce, a leader if they will, because businesses will want that.
Exactly.
So it's a lot more than just
Just
swinging the golf club well. That's
alone the
part of
fact.
it.
Well, I mean, but golf teaches all those things. I mean, it's a
You bet
character
it does.
building,
Yeah.
character building activity if you do it the right way. And the fact that they speak 5 hours of English with you a day is that'll or hearing that alone is a benefit, I would imagine.
Well, the kids in my program are all go to pretty much all go to international schools, so
Okay.
their English is
The English
perfecto, right?
perfect. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which club is your school based at?
So it's based at a place called Emeralda,
Yeah, I know
golf
that place.
course. You know it? Yeah. There's 27 holes there. So we go out on the golf course on Fridays, and interestingly enough, last week we had our first short course training and I think you'll find this interesting, the first short course training. So all golf courses have different colors that represent the different tee areas. So we call the The longest course is called the long course. The shortest course, which is usually the red tees, is called the short course. So I took our best players out on the short course the other day. So we don't call it the red tees or the ladies tees. We call it the short course. And they go out there and they've got big expectations because they can drive the green and or get it really close to the par fours, and they can reach the par fives with short irons or mid irons, and they of course go out there with the expectation they're going to shoot a crazy low number. But as I always remind them, you still got to putt the ball into the hole. You still got to pitch the ball close enough to the hole. You've got to play the game of golf. And it might be a short course, but it doesn't make it an easy course by any stretch of the imagination. And the same thing goes when we play the course at 7,300 yards. That's very long, especially for some of the kids. But I say that's fine. It just simply means you're going to be, again, wedging the ball around a lot and putting it a lot. You're going to need your short game in both cases a lot. And so much of golf today, unfortunately, there's this real drive to hit the ball further and all of these things, which is, look, I understand that. But I also understand that the underlying reason for that is to sell golf equipment. And that's whether we want to believe that or not, that's the underlying reason. And it drives a lot, right? So the big corporate marketing machines make people think we've got to have the new head driver, we've got to have another shaft in it. We've got to go and get fitted. We've got to increase our clubhead speed by, 10 miles per hour, whatever. And when you look at the agenda, when you look at the core principle driving that, you go, it's mostly marketing. Because at the end of the day, most people aren't going to be able to get the gains that they in their mind believe they're going to get. So what you're going to want to be better at, again, playing the game, is certainly about swinging the golf club and hitting good golf shots. But mostly it's about missing the greens and being able to make pars or get the ball close enough to reduce a double bogey into a bogey or a triple bogey into a double bogey and so on, right? It's the game of score again. And so that's a huge emphasis in our program, Frank. There's a lot of time spent developing the skills around the green, all the different types of skills. And they start with very basic skills and then they learn more advanced skills as they go along until they become pretty clever.
And you have you have them all in one group, or you split them up or
No, they're
by
all
age or?
in. They break up into smaller groups, and some things that all the group gets. Well, most of the group, my elite players don't. They've usually got their own stuff. So we've got a periodized program. In other words, we've got this program broken down into all sorts of segments. Our elite players have their own stuff they work on, so they do come in and get involved in some of the games. Like there's a lot of gamification in our program, so they come in for the team games
They
and
need
the
that.
competitions. Absolutely, they do. And so they'll come in for that, but they may have their own projects. So while I'm working with some of the younger kids doing short game skills, they might be on the range working because it's all really close where I am. So I can walk between the two very easily. It takes a couple of minutes, not even. So I'm managing, the people in whatever, like they're almost in pods, if you will. So certain skills are being learned. So some of them are group skills, certainly putting skills. We've just gone and done our KPIs for the first quarter of this year. So our official training starts February because January they're still on holiday and so on. So we start officially, so February, March, April. So we set our targets for that. So we've got KPIs for a number of the different routines that we've got. So even our elite players, our pros and the amateurs have got their own KPIs and they're on the same board as the other kids. So the kids actually see the goals of our elite players, which also inspires them a lot and makes them realize just how good some of these kids are. Doing the same routine. In other words, like one of our routines, SG 35, that's short game 35, that's 35 holes around the green. There are seven different skills, chipping, pitching, lob shots, trouble shots, rough shots, sand shots, and approach shots. And so they go through this cycle of seven skills, and they do that five times, 35 holes. And we also have 70 holes, which takes that's a 4 to 5 hour routine. So our elite players usually do twice as much of that in terms of stroke volume they're doing. But the point being that they see on the scoring on the board the types of targets the elite players are aiming at. So our kids might be sort of 40 over par for 35 holes because it's quite challenging. You've seen our short game area. It's designed for tournament. It's I have it every week designed so that the tournaments are in, sorry, the pins on the green, the six pins, they're in tournament locations. So they're within 2 meters of the edge of the green. I also have different length roughs. So when they're playing this game, the course is quite challenging. So they might be shooting, say, 40 over for 35 holes, whereas our elite players are shooting, say, 10 or 12 over par, which is a really good result, given how tough the course can be. Two things they learn from it. One is that they can get better because they know these kids started with being at a different place. And two, they also learn how to better manage the way they practice. So they realize pretty quickly that if they make those seven skills too hard for themselves, they're going to have very high scores and they're never going to go anywhere. So they learn how to get balance with their scoring. They learn how to design their training so that, because I supervise it, but I don't get involved too much with them, only where I can advise them to do something a little bit better. Otherwise, I'm just watching what they do. I'm more inclined to watch to see how they behave under pressure, and then that's where I work to get them into a different place. And then any skill work we do, I do it right there on the spot. So if there's an issue, I'm never going to go back and talk to them about it outside of that. Like, it's not like, say, a clinical psychologist who you play badly on the golf course, Frank, and then you go and lie on a couch and talk to a clinical psychologist in an office in some office tower somewhere. We can't do that. We've got to be addressing it where it happens so that they understand what that means in that context.
Do you use any training aids like video or TrackMan, or does that play a role?
Yeah, we've got tech like that, which we use, but the more elite players use it more often. Say, for instance, they'll go through and they'll use it for checking their distances before they go to a tournament. The kids, when we do basic assessments, like every quarter we do an assessment, so we assess a whole range of different skills. So I usually use the technology to collect the data on that so that I know, that when we're setting our KPIs, we know where we're setting them from, that they're coming from a good source. So we do things like that. So we have a GC quad that we use. But again, we don't use it. It's not like it's out there all the time. It's not. Most of our stuff's gamification. It's training games that they're individually doing where they're scoring for themselves, but they're also part of a group
And they're
and
playing the
doing
game.
a. Yeah, absolutely. Everything's about playing the game. That's.
I love that you call it the long course and the short course, because, and I never really thought about this, it's a different golf course. And when you say
Yeah.
I'm playing from the black tees, the blue tees, or the red tees, you feel like you're playing the same golf course. But
Yeah.
when you call it the long course, the short course, and the medium course, you understand that it's a different golf course
Yeah,
from.
and we mix it up as well, Frank. We sometimes go short, mid, long, or random. So I can mix it up any way I like. But literally, when they play, say, the short course, and they're playing a what was a long par four from the long course, but now is a very short hole. It takes on. It's like they're playing a radically different golf hole, like radically different. Everything's in a different place. Like, it could be water around the greens that was never really an issue from 120 out, but now it comes into play because the tee shot they can reach the green. So, in other words, the challenge level is constantly changing because we're not playing the same golf course all the time. We're playing it in different ways. So again, I'm looking for variation all the time. There's very got to be variability in it because the game, that's the nature of the game, Frank. It's always changing. And so if you're not training people to adapt constantly to the variables in the game, or these constant variations in the way it's played, if you're not doing that, then what are you doing? What is being taught?
You mentioned you work on quarterly progress reports, I guess, for every student, every young man or woman. Can you walk us through how you would set quarterly goals? Because
Absolutely.
I think that's to me, it's one of the elementary things, is to be able to set goals and to be able to differentiate between performance goals, outcome goals, and process goals.
Absolutely,
How are you going
for
to get
sure.
better if you don't?
Yeah,
That's why I get.
raise the bar a little bit, right? Just
How
because that's what.
do you talk to them about goal setting? setting goal?
Well, it's a fair bit involved in it, but at the simplest level, it's okay, what is it that you would like to do that you're currently not doing? And usually with the kids, when they set a goal for a particular one of our routines, they'll stretch themselves miles. And I'll say to them, look, one of the great things about goal setting is it's not set in stone. It's got to be flexible because you might get halfway through this 12-week period and find that you're actually really either too far away from it or you've achieved it in 6 weeks instead of 12 weeks. So we can move the bar around a little bit, right? As you need to be able to do.
Not only do we have the three different types of goals, we have short-term, medium-term, and long-term goals.
Right, absolutely. And we've got in our program as well, besides that, where it all comes together is it comes together in our 5 to 7 day goals are our what's called our microcycle. Our microcycle is the shortest goal period. It's our training tasks that we do through the week that lead us towards our outcome goals. And our outcome goals might be at the end of the year. So we're looking at a macro cycle, we're looking at a big picture view, like end of season goals. And then along the way, we have 28-day cycles, which are mesocycles. So we have 28-day funnels, if you will, and the micro cycles, that's our 5 to 7 day cycles, in our case, 5 days, they fit into those 28-day cycles. So our goals are actually, we have our training tasks, which in our training days, the routines they're working on, it could be technical routines, it could be targeting routines, it could be depending on when the tournaments are on, because everything about our program is geared around where tournaments are. So if we're closer to tournaments, our training is going to be more at targeting skills, like hitting it to targets. We might use more technology there because we want accurate feedback on how far the ball's flying, the dispersion of the ball is, et cetera.
That
But
would
when
be,
the
excuse me, that would
go
be, for example, hitting more greens in regulation.
correct, yeah,
Okay.
absolutely, a lot more, and also scoring around the greens, a lot more about targets and results and scoring type games. Whereas we might be working in what we call a general preparation phase, where we're quite a ways from our first tournament, we would be doing more technical work and doing high volume work, like a lot more strokes being executed, less targeting involved, but more refinement of technique. So these goals are changing and morphing based on where the tournaments are. If tournaments are close and they're coming into a pre-tournament period, then we're going to be doing more scoring type goals. We're going to work more on the focusing, getting the focus right, fine-tuning pre-shot routines and so on to make sure that they're really tight. There's not much variation. What I mean by that, for example, is when we measure pre-shot routine, we do that a couple of ways. One of the main ways we do that is the kids are allowed to use their phone. Mind you, Frank, in our program, another thing about our programs, the kids aren't allowed to use any social media, but they do use their phones for scoring. We have a lot of our routines are on apps, so they've got training sheets that they fill out it and so on, but they can't use social media. There are penalties for being caught. Now, they usually don't though, so which is great. They don't, sneak a look and
They don't
see.
want to run any more laps in 90-degree heat.
No, they don't want to do any of that. But when we're measuring, so pre-shot routine, let's say at the beginning, and a kid comes to the program, they've got really no idea what a pre-shot routine is. So we have a session and we talk about what pre-shot routine is, that it's this thing you do before you walk into the ball. And what's the goal of it? The goal is to get you psychologically ready to be able to stand up over your shot, hit the shot the way you want. Now, when you do that, there's a certain behavior that takes place and it takes a certain amount of time. So it's what we call a time signature. So the behavior has a time signature attached to it. The time signature is how long does it take for someone to stand behind the ball and start moving, walk in, shape up to the ball, hit the shot? How long does that take? So we measure it. And so we do sets of shots where we're measuring their behavior. And then we're looking, so number one is we measure that. So we're looking to see how much variation there is in over, say, 10, 20, 30 shots, right? So it's supposed to be the same routine every time.
Can you put a number of seconds on a good pre-shot routine or a range? Hello? We're back.
Okay, great. Yeah, so pre-shot routine. Okay, so we want to do two things. We want to measure how long does it take for them to do the routine, and what is the range of the routine? So let's say it's 10 swings, Frank, and the idea is that they're going to make 10 swings that the routine's exactly the same. That's the idea. But we look at those 10 swings, and the range is, say, between their fastest time and their slowest time is, let's say, 3 or 4 seconds. So I said, what's going on in there? Why is there 3 or 4 seconds difference? Why is it not the best players in the world that's within a second? So that's an education for them to start with. They go, oh, really? I say, yeah, the best players in the world, you could be hiding behind a tree with a stopwatch and you can measure them any particular place on the golf course, and that routine will be within a second. But I said, the worse the golfer, the bigger the range. So these kids might come into the program and have a 5 second, even 6 seconds, because there's more stuff going on. So number one, we're measuring that range, fastest time to slowest time. Number two, then we go through a routine of mapping the behavior, looking at what they actually do and whether they do what they do the same way every time or not. So just to give you an idea, when we're fine-tuning routines for tournaments, we're doing those things. We're going, is the time signature tight? Is the behavior consistent? Are they doing both those things together? So there's a lot of things you can work on in golf that actually are meaningful, that actually can make a difference. Because you would be, if you thought about this, with a lot of the people that are listening in on your show who are average golfers, but they're really keen, they want to be better at the game, that I guarantee you almost none of them would be measuring those two things. If I hit 10 or 20 shots, what's the range? What's my shortest time? In other words, what's the gap? What's the gap number? And number two, is my behavior in that routine the same every time, or is it different?
Out of personal interest, how many yards away from the ball can a pre-shot routine start?
It's a good question. With my kids, we usually two big steps. We don't want to be walking from 3 or 4 or 5 steps away. It's kind of like a stroll into the ball. So we really want one, two, we're at the ball, and then turn in and go through the routine. Two steps is enough.
Behind the
I've
ball,
also,
club in the same hand, all of those
yeah,
elementary things,
I've been heavily influenced by a professor, Juri Hannanen, who's a Finnish professor who wrote a. I have a textbook that he has this theory called the individual zone of optimal functioning, eyes off. And he talked about how athletes come in and out of routines at different times. Some people are in there fast, some people take more time. When I looked at golfers, when I was working through his stuff and trying to understand it in the context of golf, now I looked at some of the best golfers in the world, and I was able to, obviously, because I can go to YouTube, I was able to get on YouTube and get my phone out and put my timer on and say, look at the walk-in routine of, say, Annika Sörenström or Kari Webb or Ben Hogan or Tiger Woods or whoever I wanted. And I could start jotting it down and mapping it out. And, Nicklaus was, without being into the specifics, but Nicklaus was taking more than 20 seconds from the walk-in to hit the shot. A lot of time spent over the ball, moving his body, looking at the target. Norman, who modeled his game off Nicklaus as a young man, also 20 odd seconds. And then Tiger Woods more down in the 14 second range. Ben Hogan down 10, between 10 and 12, like fast, pulls the trigger quickly. It was interesting to me that people have these different time signatures. It's the best way to describe it. That this physical thing that they do as they move into the shot and hit their shot, and then how consistent they are with that. And what I continually found was that the best players in the world, they nail it all the time. So it's not only behavior is consistent, the amount of time it takes, the signature is the same as well.
And everybody has a different signature, whether it's just a half a second difference between the greatest players on
Or it could be
the
5 seconds different.
Yeah, from
Yeah,
Bolton 10 to Nicklaus
yeah. So
20. I mean,
they're all hitting it, but they're hitting it with this. So this internal mechanism that runs the golf game. And that at their level, it's automatic, which is an important point, Frank. It comes back to that point of what's it ultimately look like? What do we want it to be? So when I'm working with players, I'm going, well, you want to be able, at that place where you can just walk in and hit the golf shot and not think too much about how you do it. And when I say not think too much about it, I mean not think too much about it. I mean, you've done so much practice of the right types of things that you walk in and you can hardly remember that you walked in to hit the shot because you were so engaged in this routine. You've gone in from this level of awareness, where I've got a broad focus to a very narrow focus when I'm executing the shot. So these things in our program are vitally important for them to learn, and they develop them over time. It's sort of shaping it all the time.
When the kids play 18 holes in 90 degrees Fahrenheit, do they walk? Do they ride? Do they push? Do they pull? What do they do?
That's good. They do both in Indonesia. They could be riding in a cart with caddies. That happens, and it's not something I agree with, but it's the way the culture is here. And but when they're playing internationally, some of my better kids, they're going to be carrying their bag or
They're going to carry. Okay.
yeah.
One thing that many people don't know what to do with, and the pre-shot routine, and then the post-shot routine,
Yeah, how you respond to it and so
how
on.
you respond to that.
Yeah.
Many people have no idea how to deal with the minutes and between shots, walking from
Yeah.
shot to from ball to ball, riding there, those kind of things. What do you tell a 12-year-old kid, a 14-year-old kid, a 16-year-old kid to think about when they're not in their pre-shot routine or in their post-shot routine?
It's different things for different kids, but it's a walk in the park. We're enjoying the walk, and what songs do you know that you can sing along the way? Because you want to engage with the environment as much as you can. At least that's what I want to teach the kid, not only the kids, the adults that I coach online and so on as well. I want them to understand that this is not, it's not 5 hours of intense concentration. It's
Nobody can do that.
a switch on, switch off game, right? So we switch on when you're going in from broad to narrow. So from a broad focus to a narrow focus. You go from a state of walking down the fairway, and you could be connecting with nature, talking to your friend, doing any number of those things, which is completely fine and should be done, to okay, now you quite often you'll see pros in tournaments, they'll walk down the fairway together, Frank, and then they'll peel off, right, as they go to their ball with a caddy. And they're having a good old conversation about whatever, but it's certainly not about what they're doing on the day. They're not discussing how they're playing and how bad they're playing because no one wants to hear it for a start. You want to be the most unpopular person in the club. Talk about your bad day you had, because no one wants to hear it. No one cares. I remember years ago, I got to tell you this story about
Please.
a pro that I was coaching who's playing on the tour, and he said one, and this is years ago, and he's playing, and this is when Greg Norman was at the height of his powers, and he said I was playing in the group in front of him, and I'm playing really well, but we were held up on the tee. Oh, sorry, second shot into a par five, and Norman's behind us. And there's a huge crowd following Norman because in those days, like when Tiger played, everyone is following Norman. Like he was just this amazing draw card. And so that they didn't have that. But of course, every time people would catch up because they wanted to be in front of Norman, there's a massive crowd. And so he got this instant crowd with him wherever he went, which is great. But he said he said what really was distracting for him out on the course was he kept looking back at Norman, leaning on his club like he was looking at him. I said, you know what? Norman doesn't give a care about you. He probably doesn't even know you exist in the field. He's probably thinking about something entirely else. He's just leaning on his club, waiting because he's used to waiting, right? It's, in pro golf, it gets like that. So, but that helped him enormously because he realized that at the end of the day, no one really cares about you, right? So you're caring, you care, but no one else really cares. And certainly they don't want to hear your sorrow about the way you played on the.
I mean,
Those
that's
are my kids. That's why we say, what are three things you did well today? What are three things you want to improve on? And it's not positive talking or anything like that. It's just a reality of being flexible with your thinking when you play, whether you play well or not. It's obviously easier to say, what did you do well when you've had a really good round? And can be challenging when you've had a terrible round, but that's the part of the training. That's the whole point of it. and moving beyond the words to the transformation part we talked about before is how is the behavior different? How are you acting differently when you have to?
Well, buying a new driver every year is probably something that you discourage your kids to do.
Yeah.
We're talking about
So,
the
yeah,
equipment.
the parents will buy them stuff. And look, I'm not saying that technology is not fantastic, but at the end of the day, it's negligible how much of an improvement it makes if you're not hitting it out of the center of the club face. If you hit anything out of the center, it goes better.
They're telling us how shit last year's driver was, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Another thing I saw on one of your pages was how in a rain delay, or when it was raining, you couldn't go out. You sat down your kids and you watched with them a podcast by our mutual friend Rick Sessinghouse.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. They're all fans. They've all got great things to say. They're all of them. Anyone that's out there and working a lot with people, whether it's Rick with at the mental end of the game, or anyone else, they've all got good things to say. And I want my kids to get some education around that.
All the best.
So, yeah. But the thing is that education is a component, right? In my class, it's a school, and a school has it's got a curriculum, and part of that curriculum is education, like the a theoretical side to it as well. I want them to be able to not only just hear a few words. I want to, for instance, now we've got we did a class last week, and I'm doing more online classes now because I can, Frank, so I can spend more time with them. So I prepare an online class through the week, and we did probability theory last week, and I think well. And they're not, some of them aren't even doing that in high school yet, but I wanted to show them how probability theory works, law of large numbers. Like when you look at a big enough picture of something, you can see patterns in things that you can't necessarily see in a small sample size. So we talked a little bit about it at the level that they understand it. It's like it's golf instruction, it's golf theory, but it directly impacts them because they get upset with themselves and they go, oh, coach, they recognize patterns because humans, we're great at pattern recognition. We see things very easily. And so we go, oh, I got a couple of balls going off to the right. There's a problem. We go, no problem at all. That's just information. That's just data. And if we've got enough of that, it's going to tell us a story. So we want to understand a little bit about probability because we want to say, well, what's the likelihood of improvement? Well, if we do these things and we do enough of it, there's enough sample size, there's enough effort gone into it, there's enough strokes made, we're going to be able to move that in the direction of where you want to go. But we're probably not going to see it in 1 month's work. It's probably 3 months or more. And so it brings everybody back to a place where they feel a little more comfortable and they're less, they're not as tough on themselves when things aren't going right. Like some of the pros that I'm working with in our program, we're making long-term changes. And I say, the reason we're doing this is not for now. It's so that in 10 years' time, when you're out there and you're a tour veteran, you've been out there for 10 years, these things are in place. So we're setting them in place now. And then with all the work that you can do and all the experience of traveling and playing, later on, you're not even going to have to worry about these things. So, in coaching, you have to have a big picture view of everything. And that's hard for a lot of people. Because especially in golf, they want it now. They don't want to have to wait too much. If they have a package of 10 golf lessons with their local pro, they want to be able to do at the end of the 10 lessons what they planned in their mind to do. But I say it might take you 100 lessons to get it.
Very, very interesting topic, managing expectations. That's
Right.
what that is. I mean,
Absolutely. Yeah, you bet it is. That's why probability theory comes into it and why I mentioned it, in my book, why it's in my book, and why score variability is in my book, because these are the things I bump into all the time, Frank. I bump into people that are talking, oh, my kids' scores are inconsistent. I go, yeah. And what do you mean they're inconsistent? Well, this week he's gone out and he's shot, 80, 93, what have that's inconsistent. I go, yeah, but it's a really small amount of rounds of golf. Let's look at it when he's played 30 rounds of golf and see what it looks like. And you're going to see this undulating wave. It's not going to be moving in a linear fashion. It's wave-like. It's going to behave like a wave. And so You need to educate people about the reality, the nature again. Frankly, come back to the nature of the game. It is an inconsistent game by its nature. How can it be a consistent game? Nothing about it is consistent. The golf swing's changing all the time because it's changing to suit the conditions of where the ball lies and what your target is in the distance, whether you're playing out of the rough or off the turf, whether it's uphill, downhill, side hill, whether you're into a breeze downwind, whether it's hot, whether it's cold. There's just countless variables. So the idea that you can have consistency in your game, which is something people ask for, they go to the pro and they say, and pro says, what do you want? Oh, I want to be more consistent. Fair enough. I understand what they mean by that. I think I understand.
What do you think they
But
mean?
I think they mean that they want to
Predominantly.
hit more golf shots that are consistent with their expectations. But that's a tough one because the best in the game hit bad golf shots. They don't hit a lot, but then the best in the game, the ones we notice, they're the rare few. That's the 0.001% of golfers. Like they are so rare, they're like the geniuses of the world.
They don't show us the bad shots on TV anyways.
No, they don't. No, they don't. And
But
that's part of a problem,
but
but
you
they
see
hit them,
the best
right?
players in the world shooting 62 one day and 75 the next, 13 shots different. That's not
Great, great
uncommon at
example.
all.
Great example. Yep, that's right. So
So
consistencies are probably not the best word for golf. Consistency in behavior, sure. If you are standing behind a golf ball and you can walk into the ball and tighten up your routine so that there's less variation in it, that's going to be helpful over time, but it's never going to be perfect. None of it's going to be perfect, right?
None of
Putting stroke, you can stand over 100 strokes around the hole and you can putt those drills and knock it into the hole, but you'll miss one or two for sure.
Well,
Maybe
that's
more.
talk about putting. I would imagine when if probability is in your curriculum, you talk to them obviously about the rules of golf, the history of golf, course management, those kind of things, just
Yeah, it's all part of our curriculum. Absolutely. Yeah.
all part of it.
Yeah.
Putting, managing expectations is still something. Somebody once said to me, if you, when we were playing a lot and playing well, and he said to me, he goes, if you come out here today, you don't practice during the week, you just play on the weekends, and you come out here and you expect to break 80, that's like going to a strip joint and expecting to fall in love. That to me was the one sentence, the one piece of advice that taught me how to manage my expectations. And this was, Lori, this was 40 years ago, or 35 years ago. And then it still works. Let's talk about the putting.
Sure.
Do your kids aim point?
No. Well, if they do, they do their own. I don't teach aim point. If I've got anything that I want them to learn is I want them to putt quickly, not slowly.
What do you think of professional golfers? Maybe they have a point, aim point, but amateur golfers trying to feel the break of a putt with their feet. I don't get it. I mean, is it better than the eyes? Is it a confirmation of, are they looking for confirmation of what they see? I mean, obviously you don't teach aim point and I don't really know much about it, but alone the concept of trying to feel it with your feet by straddling the line,
I don't know enough about aim point to talk about it. I've got friends that teach it and so on, but I'll say this. I've had people that I've trained over the years that use it and they putt as badly as anybody else I've ever seen. So regardless of whether they're standing there and feeling with their feet, they miss plenty. And they could still have a bad attitude in the way they miss it as well. I think that ultimately with putting, like ultimately with golf itself, the closer you can get to the instinct side of things where you're just reacting more to the condition and making decisions easily and quickly and get on with it, the better you are. In fact, I did see some research done on the European tour a bunch of years ago where they essentially went like this. We tracked a whole lot of players and their routines, and we found that the players that had shorter routines that took less time putting and long game played better, made more money than those that took longer. So in other words, I think if you stretch out the timeline, if the signature is longer, you have more time to think thoughts. Of course, you are going to because the brain, that's its natural state. Its natural state is to think thoughts. We
Thanks.
speak in a language, so we think in a language. So we're thinking thoughts, right? So What I want to do is get it to a get it
Quick,
done.
like John
Throw
Daly.
it. Yep.
Step up
So
to it
see
and
it, pick the brake, don't question the brake, trust your gut. And then if it doesn't work, accept it. One of the great things you learn from Asian wisdom is the understanding of acceptance.
Well, you know
Like
what?
not the word acceptance, Frank, but literally, I accept what's happened. I accept it. And I move on
Big
because,
difference.
in other words, when I walk off the green, it's done. I left it there. It went in, it didn't go in. I left it there. I don't go to the next tee with it.
I mean, those are huge things to teach adults and even to teach successful people. It's amazing how you teach that to children. I mean, maybe it's easier. I don't know. But it's just incredible.
Well, kids are miniature adults. They're modeled in the shape and ways of their parents. So they think a lot like their parents at an early age. They get it's the normal, all normal part of imprinting.
I just
So I have to start at a young age.
I just read this unbelievable study yesterday. I still can't believe it. Some British institute did a study. And that 4-year-old kids, on the average, ask 390 questions a day. It's unbelievable.
That's
When they
amazing,
sleep in
isn't it?
12 hours, right? So
Yeah,
they're
yeah.
asking a question every 2 minutes. And
Look out. Your
I
young son will
know.
be your
Thank
young
God
son
he's
will be
only
doing that.
three, but
Yeah, he's on his way.
you're right. That makes them young adults.
Yeah. So training them to get into these sorts of things, these ways of thinking, get it done fast, get over it quickly. Get it done fast, get over it quickly. Right? And then train it. Don't just say it. Train it. I hear some. I listen to a lot of podcasts, Frank, and I hear some absolute superlatives coming out of coaches and that. And I go, at the end of the day, the great coaches are the ones that actually get people to do what they say they're going to get them to do. They change the behaviors. Because at the end of the day, otherwise, it's just a theory, right? It's just you've got this hypothesis, this idea of what you want to do. But at the end of the day, how do they do it? Can they do it? That's the part I love the most. I love that the most about coaching.
Because
Shaping people.
it
I
involves a
love
lot
it.
of work on their side when you're not with
Yeah.
them.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
It's
And so you've got to
a
do a
24
great
hour,
job
right?
when they're with you, when they're in front of you, you've got to just do the best job you possibly can. And it's got to be in the back of your mind, what's this kid going to look like if I do this properly? What's it going to look like? And sure enough, it comes to fruition. If you do the work, the kid's transforming over time, you see it. And it can happen to anybody, even adults, even though adults can be quite stubborn in their ways, and
Definitely.
they are.
The older they get, the more stubborn.
Yep, but they can still learn, right?
You mentioned it at the beginning of the program, and just as an example, you're talking about a player who was under pressure, and then he saw his father standing over there with a stern look, most parents, and especially, well, not just fathers, mothers too, are very overambitious. They don't know how to deal with when their kids fail. Then they get angry that they have to drive them there, that I bought you all the golf clubs and everything. How much do you work with the parents? I'm sure you know parents like that.
Ah, yeah, absolutely. I'm in Asia. Yeah, it's they have very high expectations with most things. Of course, academics goes without saying, right? But even golf, they get into golf and they transfer that idea from academics into golf as well without necessarily understanding enough about the game. So my job, it really is my responsibility. It's not theirs. I can get upset with them because they can interfere, but what I have to do, I have to take full responsibility and say, I need to educate them and I need to be good at that. I need to find my way, my best way to connect with them and help them to understand what this really looks like. It might be very different to the way they're looking at it because they simply don't understand enough about the game. And in most cases, particularly in Asia, that has been the case. Not so much when I was growing up in Australia, working in Australia and other places where it's more of a sporting culture. So they have a better understanding of the development of skill and aptitude for the game if you come out of a sporting culture than in a place where it's primarily academic. And so they treat a learning golf like it's a subject instead of a motor skill. So you have to teach them that they're not the same thing, and that motor skills require reps, lots of repetitions done a certain way, whereas you can go and just cram the night before in a test and probably do okay in it.
But this ambitiousness, and like I say, it's in Asia, it's very common that there's a lot of pressure on these kids to perform. I would imagine that makes your ability to shape their behavior more difficult.
Can do. I don't. I mean, because I know what I want to do, I know that it's always about that. Ever since the very first time we were up there, this second generation of kids, post-COVID, pre-COVID, we had a group of kids that over that period of time did very well from our coaching over the first 5 year period up to COVID. And but I learned a lot of things as well when I went home and really thought about it. I scrapped a lot of my programs. I looked at the research and I looked at what I was doing. I go, this is just not good enough. It's wasting their time and it's wasting mine. And I'm putting too much energy into things that are not effective enough. So, but what I have going for me in my program is it's I'm running an experiment 24/7. I'm literally testing ideas and different routines and different training tasks and so on all the time. So I've got a pretty good understanding of what works better than what doesn't, which is great. So I can get to the heart of a problem a little faster.
Well, I don't know if anybody else that is doing what you're doing, but one thing that came to mind when I was thinking about today, is that there are many top players in the world, and let's talk about Colin Morikawa, let's talk about Jordan Spieth or Justin Thomas, Morikawa with Rick Sessinghouse, that have stayed with their coaches from when they were very, very young.
Yes,
Or they
absolutely.
have gone, or they have gotten back to their coaches once they were told to switch to some other coach.
Yeah.
Craig Miller here in Germany, our recent PGA Teacher of the Year, went back to Matti Schmidt after Matti Schmidt went to somebody else who was supposed to be, oh, this great guy, and he came back to the guy who taught him, started teaching when he was 8 years old or whatever.
Yeah.
Justin Thomas, I believe, Spieth is one of the guys. Rory too. I believe is with the coach from his childhood, and the way you described it today makes me think that these coaches were also able to shape their behavior
100%. You
from
bet.
the beginning. They're not just golf coaches,
No, not at all. Now, I think there's a clear distinction between a golf teacher and a golf coach. Coach being more holistic, looking at more factors. A golf teacher might be more focused on, say, swing. He's got his studio, he's got his technology, and he's predominantly working on technique from player to player, which is fine, because certainly a lot of people need that. But elite players do not. Elite players need a lot of other things. And if I don't have those things, I've got a good enough network that I can refer my better players to, a sports psychologist if I need to, or what have you, because they're doing things at a very, very specific level that I'm not at. I mean, I can't be an expert at everything, and I don't claim to be, and I don't want to be. I'm open-minded, and I keep looking at the best ways to move my students forward and my clients online, but at the end of the day, I can use the resources of others as I need to help them get the most out of themselves. Because we come back to that fundamental thing again of performance equals potential minus interference. And if I'm interfering, and I could be, then I need to find someone who can do a better job than I'm doing to attack, to raise more of the potential in that person I'm working with. And I have no problem at all doing that.
To me, it also very much states the difference between growth and success. You might grow your game by shooting lower scores, but that doesn't mean that you're successful.
Yeah, that's a tough one, that success one, isn't it?
Well, successful to me, it involves morals and character and spirituality, maybe even not just for golf, but for business, for life, is when you can combine growth Increasing your company's turnover from 500,000 to 2 million, that's growth, not losing.
Absolutely.
So
For sure.
that's the way I see it. Talk to us quickly before we go about your new book, Mental Toughness: Quotes for Athletes, 175 Powerful Quotes to Fuel Your Athletic Journey.
Yeah, this is something I've been wanting to do for ages. Look, I've got a pile of books in my head that I want to get out, and this was going to be second along the line. I had to get the junior book out. I got that out. I'm really happy with that. But I've got all these other ones, and one of them was, having read so much stuff over the years, I wanted to actually do a book where I was getting the quotes from the researchers, the people that are right there, really looking in at, when you read all these research papers, you see all this good stuff in there, but there are people you never heard of in your life. Like they don't even quote them. Like what'll happen is they'll take some quote of, say, some researcher or some scientist, and rarely do they get the credit for it. So I went through a whole bunch of books and research papers, and I just started to compile. I've got a notebook full of quotes that I really liked, and then I was looking online, and I saw a lot of people are looking for quotes, mental toughness quotes, and I'd say it's a lot of coaches that want to use them, with their there are a few researchers that are really at the forefront of mental toughness research and so on, and it's becoming a more it's becoming a topic that is discussed a lot more, not only in athletics but across the board, business, you name it. So that's what I'm working on at the moment, and I've just got one of my previous clients who I told you about, John Pierce. He's going to write the foreword, so he's working on that at the moment. Very excited about that. John's just won his third major in tennis. Fabulous guy, and he's the epitome of that toughness. He's into his 30s now, and where athletes are starting to think about retiring, in particular in tennis, he's not. He's just he's being reinvigorated, more game, new partner to play with, because he's a doubles specialist. And but won at the Australian Open, won the mixed doubles this year, which was a fantastic effort. So John is going to do the forward for that book, and then I'll have that book out there, and that'll be another goal achieved in terms of what I want to get out there, and then I'll be working on my next one.
When do you think we can expect this one?
The goal is to have it by April. It'll
April.
be out by April. Yep.
Without taking anything away, but it's talks about resilience, bouncing back from adversity, confidence, focus and discipline, composure under pressure, mental toughness in teams, handling fear, overcoming doubt, and not just some catchphrases, but some real.
Yeah, look, can I say that to just to wrap up, that you've got to go to the end again. You want mental toughness. You don't. You might have someone that's got that as, as part of the way they are, but it's likely something's been developed. You get to Colin Morikawa. He's been working with Rick for over 20 years. It's something Rick has developed over a long period of time to get him to that place, and they would still have conversations and so on. So, the idea is that we begin with the end in mind. I want people to be tougher, more resilient, more adaptive, more responsive to the environments. You come back to the beginning and you start building you're putting it in place, like building the foundation and putting the first layer in, second layer, and so on. So that's what that's all about. And most of my coaching, the type of people that approach me, the people that I work with and have done for, well, this is my 20, my Mind on the Game business. This is 1999. I launched Mind on the Game. So that's what, 26 years now. So I've been doing the online, my clients' stuff online with people for that long. So I've not only got the kids in Jakarta, I've got all these people around the world that I work with in all sorts of, they're in all sorts of different walks of life, college
Online.
players, business people, you name it. So, and it always comes down to the same thing. What's it look like at the end? What sort of things have we got to develop to get you there? That's what coaching is all about. Ultimately, it's not rocket science
No,
at the end of the day.
it's not exactly. You have any slots open?
Yeah, it's always a slot, but not many.
Not many. Okay. Well,
No, we'll work
Mind
what
on
with
the
what I
Game.
do.
Is it mindonthegame.com?
It is. Yeah, it's
It is
mindonthegame.com. Yep.
mindonthegame.com, ladies and gentlemen. Usually when I read a book or when I look at a book for the first time, I start with a bibliography. I start from the back. It's very interesting to me. And I want to end this podcast with the first page of your book, where you write that this book is dedicated to those who stand behind the athletes, pushing them forward when doubt creeps in, holding them accountable when discipline wavers, and believing in them even when they struggle to believe in themselves. They do more than teach skills. They shape mindsets, instill resilience, and cultivate the mental toughness that transforms potential into greatness. They are the coaches, the tireless mentors, the quiet motivators, and the unwavering guides. And that is what you are, sir. And it's a pleasure, an honor, from the top shelf to spend time with you. And I thank you for being here today. Me, what you do is like from Homer Kelly to Shiva's Irons and everything in between.
Yeah,
There you
there's a
go.
lot. Yeah, it never stops. But it's been such a pleasure to catch up with you after 3 years
Yeah,
online again. And
absolutely. We got to do it again.
I'll look forward to the next one. If it's 3 years, it'll be a great story. And
Absolutely. We'll try to make it sooner.
let's do that. But it's always great, good to catch
Laurie,
up with you.
stay well. Thank you very much. We're following your kids online. Tell them that somebody in Germany is watching them when they're putting against the laps.
You know, I do. I tell
There
them
you
that,
go.
we're pretty popular outside of Indonesia. A lot of people watch what we're up to.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for your time, Frank. It's
Laurie,
been
have
a
a good
pleasure.
rest of the day.
Thank you, mate.
To the
Appreciate
Lynx
it.
Land.